There are a few cities that inflame passions, inspire fantasy, prompt violence, and perhaps promise historical fulfillment in the way the city of Jerusalem does. That's a place known from its extremities, for its political and religious intensity, and its architectural landscape offers a compelling expression of the city in all its conflict and complexity. Adina Hoffman is an essayist, a critic. She's author of Till We Have Built Jerusalem, Architects of a New City. Adina, it is an ancient and complex place, and layer upon layer in its built self.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, you could say that and say it again. I mean, I think one of the things, and actually you put that perfectly, because there's a way in which the layers are something that you have to always keep in mind. And when I think about the built city of Jerusalem in a kind of, you know, longer term historical sense, there's a way in which it's important to think not just about what you're seeing in front of you when you're walking the city streets, it's also what you're not seeing, which is maybe underfoot, but maybe it's something that's been completely erased. And that's something that, you know, I'm somebody, I love to walk and I love to look and to see what I'm seeing, the buildings and the people and all that. But it's a slightly deceptive thing to do in Jerusalem because much of what is around you is not visible. This is a city that has been basically captured and recaptured something like 44 times, I think, is the most recent count over the course of its history. And almost every power or army or civilization that conquered Jerusalem made a point of destroying certain things and building other things on top of those things that they destroyed. And on the one hand, that makes for a very rich, wonderful history and incredibly complicated. It's what makes Jerusalem so fascinating. But it also means that much of what meets the eye is not what has been. So I always think that it's critical to think about what you're not seeing at the same time that you think about what you're seeing, which is to say that when you talk about sort of what has been built in Jerusalem, you also have to think about what's been destroyed.
Well, I wonder too, is there a counter impulse to that thing of the conqueror to construct? Is there a counter impulse of defensiveness, of an architecture of anxiety, of paranoia?
Oh, absolutely. That's pretty much the history of Jerusalem architecture. I mean, some very beautiful things have come of that, in the sense that you could say, for instance, the Dome of the Rock, which is a beautiful building. And then you look at it now and everyone admires the tiling on the walls. Well, the tiling is actually the product of a certain Ottoman defensiveness against what had come before, which was a mosaic. So some of it is beautiful. But I think one of these other dichotomies that I feel like I have to say when I talk about Jerusalem is that it's an incredibly beautiful city in many respects. I mean, I remember my first encounter with the city and being totally sort of overcome by its beauty. It's also one of the ugliest places on the planet. And I don't just mean physically, I mean psychically ugly, in the sense that what people do to people there is intensely ugly, or it can be. It's not only ugly, but it can be. And what people do to people in the sense of buildings is also very ugly. It can be ugly, you know. Neighborhoods are built, buildings are weapons in Jerusalem often, so that buildings and neighborhoods are built to make a point, to create facts on the ground. Other neighborhoods and buildings are bulldozed to make other points, so that there's that. And then there's the anxiety of wanting to build, to show that we're here, that we have a presence. And sometimes that results in the kind of beauty of the Dome of the Rock, but sometimes it results in the most hideous kinds of fortresses that are simply put up to exert a kind of political presence. And that is ugliness, I think, kind of in the deepest sense, both physical and psychic.
But how extraordinary to be and to be writing about a place where everything matters, where everything is of significance.
Yeah, it's wonderful and it's totally exhausting. It's both of those things. Dichotomies prevail there. There's always like, it's beautiful, it's ugly, it's wonderful, it's exhausting. It's what you see, it's what you don't see.
And of course, a crucial dichotomy among the many is old and new. Can you say something about the historical city?
The thing that has interested me the most and that I've written about has been the modern city of Jerusalem. And it's important to understand, and I think a lot of people maybe don't know this, that basically the kind of historical city, the sacred city, the holy city that people think of when they think of Jerusalem is something that is entirely contained within a wall that existed up until the late 19th century. That was Jerusalem, was everything in that wall. So that all of these holy sites, you know, the Western Wall, which is what remains of the destroyed temple and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and the Dome of the Rock, that's all inside the walls, as are all kinds of other mosques and synagogues and churches and places where people lived and markets. But it was really only in the late 19th century that the city sort of burst its banks. And that happened in 1867, which is a year that no one ever mentions. Everyone's always talking about 1967. But 1867 is the year when the Ottoman Sultan forcibly conscripted bands of Palestinian peasants to pave a road from what is known as the Jaffa Gate. In the old city of Jerusalem, what's now called the old city of Jerusalem, it was just the city then, to the port of Jaffa. And this road basically allowed access to pilgrims and goods, and it opened the city out to the world. And as soon as that road was paved, the city kind of burst out, and a whole market like erupted around the walls. And then that road, the Jaffa Road, leading to the port of Jaffa, became the main street of Jerusalem, what is now West Jerusalem. And it was along that road that the city evolved. So that's one date. And the other date that I think it's critical to mention is 1918, which is basically late 1917, the British entered Jerusalem. They took it over from the Ottoman Empire at the end of World War I. And soon after that, a kind of enlightened, horrible, wonderful man named Ronald Storrs, who was the military governor, made a law that everything in Jerusalem had to be built in stone. And it's a material that everyone was using for many millennia, but he made it official. You had to build in the stone so that now, and this is still a law that holds today, everything must be built in stone. So when you see Jerusalem, it's a very chaotic city, but everything is basically made of the same material, which gives it this wonderful coherence in what would otherwise be very incoherent.
Now, your book tells the story of three architects. First, can you tell us who they were? What did they build, and why these three?
Yeah, these are three people, very different people, who are in to me, there are all kinds of architects you can talk about in terms of the modern city of Jerusalem, but these are the three who I love the most and who happen to have these buildings that are within just a few hundred meters of each other along one block right at the beginning of Jaffa Road. The first is a building that was first built in 1939 as the Anglo-Palestine Bank. It was the tallest building in the city at that point at 7 stories, which is kind of strange and painful now because you can go up to 30 stories, but it was shocking then that there were 7 stories. It's a kind of very dignified building. It sits at this very kind of thoughtful remove from and relationship to the street in front of it and to the very steep hill behind. It has these kind of portholes along its side, and you feel that somebody has paid a lot of attention to the context in which this building will exist. And that's not a big surprise because the person who built it is a man who was obsessed with context. This is the architect Eric Mendelssohn, who is the most famous of the three architects who I wanted to talk about. He's a German Jew who had actually a very illustrious career in Germany before he came as a refugee basically to Palestine in 1934. He actually built the Einstein Tower in Potsdam, which is a weird, wonderful building, and it's not really typical of his work, but it's his most famous building. It's in all the architecture books. But when he got to Palestine, he immediately understood that something else was required of him. And he was very angry at his colleagues and his peers who had also come from that context, who basically he thought were just plunking down European, you know, modernist buildings on Middle Eastern soil, reinforced concrete, glass. And he said, no, we are here now. We're in Palestine. And he says, he actually has a kind of manifesto in which he says, Palestine is not a virgin country insofar as architectural tradition is concerned, which is to say that there are people here who know how to build. They've been here for decades, for centuries. And we should pay attention to what they have to teach us about about the way that the light is here and the way that the stones are here. And this is, of course, attached to a larger political program. In his mind, he had a vision of a kind of new Semitic commonwealth that was going to involve Arabs and Jews. And he was furious at these other people who he thought were just doing these cheap European buildings. And he wanted to build in stone, in this stone that was mandated, but he thought it was like a wonderful challenge. So this bank building, he describes it when it is first opened as, you know, meant to invoke the stark verticals of the traditional buildings of Hebron and the colors of the mosque at Jaffa and the houses of Damascus. I mean, unfortunately, much of what he was talking about was falling on very deaf ears, because this was a building, as I said, that went up in 1939. It was in the middle of incredible political strife, lots of violence. It was the end of a great big uprising, the first great uprising of the Palestinian Arab community. It was a very hard time to build. There were sort of strikes in the quarries, and there was a lot of violence. And he's talking about, you know, sort of stark verticals, and who cares at some level.
What a stunning aspiration.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that's so wonderful and painful about a figure like Mendelssohn. He ended up leaving. He was basically, the city kind of spat him out in a way. I mean, he was a very arrogant man and is a kind of, you know, stereotypical starkitect in a way. He needed to have his way and everything must be this way. But he was a wonderful architect. And so the fact that he couldn't sort of build the building, I mean, he did build wonderful buildings, but I think it was very hard for him. And at a certain point, he felt that he could simply no longer continue to work in a context in which he was going to have to be sort of subservient to the place. He actually, there's a wonderful, terrible, horrible, painful letter that a friend of his, who was a great supporter, wrote to him and basically said, you know, there's no room for a prima donna here, because the only prima donna here is Palestine itself. You know, you cannot be this great man. You have to submit. So that's the first building on our itinerary. And I haven't actually done a great job of describing the building itself, more the man who built it. But it's a very...
I sense that that's the significant part.
But right next to it, and this is an amazing thing. So right next to it is this other incredible building, which is the Central Post Office. And it's still the Central Post Office. And it's a building that I and my husband, we visit it almost every day to go check our mailbox, to get ourselves out of our house. And it was the largest and most expensive building built by the British mandatory authorities. The British ruled Palestine from 1918 to 1948.
How very British that it should be a post office.
Exactly, a post office. And it's like... It's a beautiful building. It's a very stately building in a way, but it's a sly building. And this is the product of the imagination of its builder, who was a man who was the chief architect of the British government in Palestine from 1922 to 1937, which is quite a long period. And it's also a very various period. Like 1922 was one thing in Palestine, and 1937 was another. It was already a much more violent place. This was a man named Austin St. Barbe Harrison, very different from Eric Mendelssohn. He was very British. He was a civil servant. On the one hand, I called him in my book the most private of public servants. He was actually a descendant of Jane Austen. His first name is named for Jane Austen. And he was a man, a very sensitive, smart, private person who basically fled England as a very young man. He actually went to college in Canada, came back only to serve as a stretcher bearer in the First World War to England, and then he left for the East, and he never came back. He spent his whole life, adult life, in Greece and Egypt and Palestine and Malta, and he schooled himself, and he was fascinated by Byzantine architecture and Islamic architecture, and this completely informed these buildings that he was building for his colonial bosses, so that he built Government House, for instance, in Jerusalem, which is, you know, is like the official house of the people in, you know, the governor, the high commissioner of Palestine, and it is basically modeled on all kinds of Palestinian village houses. His most miraculous building is actually not the central post office, but one of my very favorite buildings in Jerusalem is what was built as the Palestine Archaeological Museum. It's now known as the Rockefeller. It's a totally magical building that no one visits. It's now in East Jerusalem, which is Palestinian, but it is under Israeli authority because the Israel Antiquities Authority is there, so that Israelis don't go because they're afraid to go to East Jerusalem. Palestinians don't go because it's very obviously an Israeli institution. Tourists don't go either because they don't know or because they're afraid. It's a beautiful building in which Harrison basically takes all of his knowledge of all of these different architectures, and he makes a building that has like echoes of Crusader forts and Byzantine churches and Islamic mausoleums and Palestinian village houses and Ottoman mansions and what he calls the Romanesque, such as one finds in Sicily, and even the Court of the Myrtles at the Alhambra. It's an amazing building. It's totally deserted. When I was writing my book, I spent many hours there. I was the only person in the building. But the post office that he also built, it was his last building. It's also got very subtle, but still interesting echoes of this Eastern aesthetic, so that there are like these stripes of black basalt in the grayer stone. It's a Syrian technique and it's called ablak. There are these amazing heavy wooden doors that have this sort of ornamental, it's ornament that he has basically copied from much older Islamic models. Unfortunately, before the building was finished, he fled also. He literally fled in the night. He didn't even like sell off his furniture. That had to happen after. He didn't tell anyone he was going. He was a kind of a pacifist, and the violence that surrounded him there, I think, just crushed him, and he had to leave. He actually left the civil service at that point too, and went eventually to Cyprus. I left out Cyprus, where he was great friends with Lawrence Durrell, who dedicated the book Bitter Lemons to him. And there's a wonderful portrait of Harrison in that book of Durrell's.
I'm sure he was written by Evelyn Waugh.
Exactly. No, he seems like a character. Like, as I was writing this, I'm like, I'm actually not making this up. He's like, he's real. He's real. And he's wonderful and poignant and kind of, and the buildings, I mean, I have to say, I'm talking about these people who left, but they left the buildings behind them, even though they were forced out in a way. The buildings are still very much there, so that I just am with them all the time. I feel like I'm having conversations with these guys, even though they couldn't stay. I don't know how much longer I can hold on either.
Well, your third is perhaps the most enigmatic.
So the third person and the third building is much closer to what's now known as it's Zion Square, which is the main sort of square of West Jerusalem. There's a building that is totally not famous. Both the bank and the post office are quite well known, and whatever, people, they're monuments. This is a building that you wouldn't notice. If you're just walking down the street, it's basically, there are some cafes, there's a hamburger joint, there's a nail salon and a 24-hour grocery. But if you look up, you see an amazing thing, which is this bizarre orientalist kind of situation, which involves both the most beautiful Armenian ceramic tiles that are set into the front of this building, this incredibly kind of bizarre crenellation on the top of the building, and these horseshoe windows. So you have this kind of very late 1920s sort of almost oriental kind of, I wouldn't say Art Deco, but it seems like there's this great stylish thing going on. And now in modern Jerusalem, you also have people hanging their laundry and all kinds of really grimy air conditioner units and floor rags hanging out the side and a couple of ripped Israeli flags. And it's all jumbled together there. And you would just never know from looking at this building that it was once the height of chic. It was a building that was commissioned by a well-to-do Christian Arab from a nearby village. And it was known in its day as Spiro Houri House. Who is Spiro Houri? I wanted to know. And in fact, Spiro Houri is the man who built the house. He was an architect. And as you can hear from that name, it's a strange name. Spiro is obviously a Greek name. Houri is an Arab name. Houri is it's a very common last name in Palestinian culture. It means priest. But who was this person? He has this kind of melded identity. And so I set out on a kind of crazy quest to find out who this person was, because it turns out that he, Spiro Horry, seems to have been responsible. And I have to say seems to have been, because it's all very murky, but he seems to have been responsible for most of the buildings in Jerusalem that have this unbelievable ceramic work on the front. Some of it, there's one building that has Quranic inscriptions written into the beautiful floral tiles. There are others that are just these beautiful mansions that have this stuff on the side. And I wondered, who is this man? And like, how is it? And as I began to research, I learned that the people he was building, okay, he himself is a kind of hybrid. And he's Greek, he's Arab, and the people he was building for were, it was everyone. He built for Muslims and Christians and Jews and Sephardic Jews and Ashkenazi Jews and Greeks and Turks. And he also, he built according to the sort of tastes of each of his clients. It's not like Mendelssohn where you look and you say, this is a Mendelssohn building. No, this man was building according to whatever people wanted, which on the one hand sounds like a bit of a put down. You know, people talk about eclectic architecture. It's like, it's mixed up. It's not clear. But I actually came to feel as I looked for this man, and I should say that I was looking for him in the middle of the summer of 2014, in the middle of the war in Gaza, and it was a totally insane quest to find out who is this missing Greek Arab architect as Israel was kind of raining down hell on Gaza. I came to feel that he was a kind of representative of a certain way of being in Jerusalem that involved eclecticism in the best sense. He was able to cross these borders and to meld these identities and to not fear that sort of cross-fertilization, which to my mind is what has made Jerusalem what it is. And it's something that's being forgotten because, you know, now we live in a time in Jerusalem of a kind of either or. You're either with us, you're against us, you're either here or you're there, you're an Arab, you're a Jew. And this man, this mystery man, Spiro Horry, seems to have been able to cross over and to meld. And I don't think he was alone. I think he was representative of something that was much more pervasive at that point. It's still there in Jerusalem. And I think it's like the best, what I love about Jerusalem has to do with that, but it's very much in danger. And I feel like there's a way in which the more that Jerusalem becomes a monolithic culture of one religion or one culture, the more doomed it is. And that the only hope for the city that I love so much and that pains me so is that somehow that sort of multiplicity could be embraced again.
Adina, what a perfect note on which to end. Thank you for your time. Adina Hoffman, she's an essayist, critic, author of Till We Have Built Jerusalem, Architects of a New City. This is Blueprint on Radio National.